Good afternoon, and thank you all for holding. I just need to inform all parties that this call is being recorded. If you do have any objections, to please disconnect. Thank you, ma'am. You may begin.
Thank you, and welcome everyone to the Charm Telecon for November. We're very excited today to have Dr. Rosalie Lopez with us. She's got extensive experience on Galileo and volcanoes, and she comes to us here on the Cassini team from the radar instrument. She's the investigation scientist for radar, and we'll be talking about the geology of Titan as seen from Cassini radar today. And Rosalie, we have the full 2 hours, but of course, usually with just one speaker, we go about an hour or so, but feel free to take your time. We do have the conference line for the full 2 hours.
Okay, I might feel hungry before then. It's lunchtime here. Well, hello all, so should I start now?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, all right. So you all got the PowerPoint, and I'm going to talk about the surface of Titan, particular geology, as seen by the Cassini radar mapper. And on this first slide, I have, first of all, the names of all the people in the team. We have a pretty large team. And I hope I got everyone in there. Our team leader is Charles Elachi, who also happens to be director of JPL, so he's a very busy guy. And we have a globe here where we show our first two swaths from our flybys. We'll just go on to the next slide now, slide two, and here I show the swaths that we have acquired during the various flybys in which we had the radar. Now, you have been following Cassini for some time, so I assume that you actually know that we actually divide the Titan flybys. They're very heavily contested between instruments, and we have some flybys for optical remote sensing, some for, radio science, and some for radar. So we only get a few of the flybys. The great advantage of radar is that it can see through the surface, and we're going to talk more about that later with more, shall we say, you know, clarity or detail than other instruments. However, a disadvantage is that in each orbit you just acquire like a swath, a fairly, you know, narrow swath, because you can't use this synthetic aperture mode from very large distances. So you have to wait until you're close to Titan to actually turn the SAR on. And we have other modes as well that I will explain. But the first globe on the left side shows TA, which was in October of last year, T3, which was in February of this year, and the second globe shows the end of T3 there in T7, where we actually had a problem with the spacecraft. Trina could go into it in great detail, and we only heard essentially half the swath. And the third globe shows our most recent swath acquired during the T8 flyby, which was in October, just last October 28. This is what we have so far. The slide number three now. Again, I assume that most of you have been coming to the telecoms for a while, so you know a lot about Titan already. But, you know, just to give you some background, Titan is actually bigger than Mercury, so it's a planet in its own right. It's stuck around Saturn, so of course it's a satellite, but this is a substantial world. Is one of three giant moons. Essentially, Ganymede is the largest moon in the solar system, Titan and, you know, Callisto, and has the second densest atmosphere of solid bodies in the solar system. And, you know, particularly, Titan is the only moon that has a substantial atmosphere. It's the only object in the solar system, apart from the Earth, to have nitrogen as its main atmospheric constituent. And it also has methane. Now, methane is a liquid at 95 Kelvin, which is the surface temperature of Titan. So that, you know, is given, of course, rise from quite some time ago that there could be liquids on the surface of Titan. And what makes Titan so interesting is that many of the processes that we see on Earth, you know, for example, the geologic processes, we think that they exist on Titan, but at much lower temperatures. And in fact, with Cassini radar, we see that all the major geologic processes that we have on Earth, we also have on Titan. So Titan is, you know, very different from the Earth. It's like, you know, I think someone called it once Earth in deep freeze. But at the same time, it's got some great similarities. It's very Earth-like in many ways. And when I was actually going to give a talk at the University of Las Vegas, I found this quote from space.com that Titan's surface temperature is lower than a lounge lizard's moral character. So I thought that was quite funny and appropriate for the seminar I was giving. So we have about 44 flybys, 45 including T0 in the main Cassini mission. We are hoping to get an extended mission and to have more Titan flybys in the extended mission. And of course, in the team, we are hoping to have much more radar. Now, slide number 4. Some Titan characteristics. You know, again, the dense atmosphere, mostly nitrogen, a few percent methane. There are scientists who, you know, atmospheric scientists, get very excited about this atmosphere and say it may be like the Earth before life evolved. Now, this shows a very nice image taken by ISS and with a filter centered at 338 nanometers, which is sensitive to UV light. And you can see here two thin haze layers. Outer layer is detached. It appears to float high in the atmosphere. And because it's very thin, this high haze layer is, you know, best seen against the, you know, at the limb. And the, you know, so the image was taken in ultraviolet. It's false color, and so you can see here that the globe of Titan appears to have this orange, you know, hue, which is what your naked eye would see, but the hazes are actually, you know, colored purple to enhance their visibility. And the best possible observations of these detached layers are made in UV light. And this is an old image, so you know, several of you have probably already seen it. And now the haze is formed by ultraviolet light breaking down methane and nitrogen molecules, and you know, and these products are, you know, thought to react to form more complex organic molecules. And so this makes the chemistry of Titan very, very interesting, all those hydrocarbons that, you know, we think exist there. But the haze also makes it tough for the imaging instrument to actually see the surface, and I'm going to show that better in the next couple of slides, which is the justification of why does Cassini have a radar. And Voyager actually just saw Titan very much as an orange globe. It did not see the surface, and that was one of the main questions, unanswered questions from Voyager. What was down on the surface of Titan? We expected something, you know, things very interesting, but this was the reason why we put a radar on Cassini. So this slide number 5 shows actually that, you know, imaging can use a near-infrared filter to see the surface, but it doesn't see the surface with the kind of resolution that you can get from radar. And I'll show here in the next slide, number 6, I borrowed this next two slides from Jonathan Lunin, a colleague of mine on the radar team. And it's a very nice example of how haze limits the information that you have in an image. So you have the Chrysler Building in New York on the left on a clear day, and on the right, picture taken by Jonathan on a hazy day. And you can do a lot of image processing, of course, and I think Jonathan just did this with Photoshop. So if you go to the next image, you see the same pair, but now the image on the right has been enhanced. And you can actually pull out, quite a bit of detail, but you still lose the information on the distance. And and if you actually look at the corners in particular, you lose the shading. So even with an infrared filter and a lot of image processing, and I do have colleagues on the imaging team that are absolute whizzes at the image processing, but there is still a limitation on what you can get out of an image. Now the next slide, number 8, shows VIMS. We also have VIMS on Cassini that can see down to the surface, and the visible and IR spectrometer. And here is a composite of false color, images taken at several wavelengths, and it shows very nicely the methane cloud at the South Pole. The inset shows the landing site. Again, this image has been released for a while. If we go to the next image, number 9, when VIMS gets the spacecraft gets pretty close to the surface and VIMS is observing a close approach, they can actually see geologic detail. Unfortunately, it's like postage stamp size areas that they can get, but one of the most interesting things they have seen is this what we call the snail. This is the subject of a paper by Christophe Sautin and others in Nature a few months ago. And this is a structure that may be a cryovolcano, and it's about 30 kilometers in diameter. So far, we haven't seen anything else quite like it, although in radar T8, there is something that appears to be similar. And the interpretation from the VIMS team is that this is some kind of cryovolcanic dome. Radar has not yet imaged this area, but I think that radar would, tell you the definite answer if we actually look at this area with our resolution. But volcanism I'm going to talk about later on because, of course, it's my favorite subject. I'm a volcanologist. Cryovolcanism was predicted on Titan. We have not seen any evidence of active cryovolcanism yet, but we have seen plenty of evidence that cryovolcanism has taken place on the surface. So, other ways to see the surface, slide 10, I'm just showing one image from Huygens, because this is just to give you some background, particularly people who may be new to this telecom. And of course, with Huygens, with the descent imager and spectral radiometer, you can see the surface in a much higher resolution than radar can give you. But again, that's just a very, very small area on the surface. It would be great if we could have had lots of probes. There may be one day that will happen. But Huygens showed channels on Titan and on this part of Titan. And in fact, we are going to look at this area later on in the telecom with radar. And the channels that are here, you can't actually resolve in the radar, which over that area was about 1,200 meters per pixel, essentially the resolution. So you actually need, there may be a lot, just lots and lots of channels on the surface of Titan that, even with radar, perhaps it's our best resolution is about 300, 350 meters, perhaps we wouldn't be able to resolve. So, slide 11, getting to Cassini radar. Having given you the justifications why we put a radar on Cassini, it's mainly to look at Titan. We do some observations of icy satellites and Saturn and the rings, but using our radiometry and scatterometry modes, not the synthetic aperture radar. But the radar instrument has, you know, the wavelength is 2.17 centimeters. It operates in four modes. Radiometry is a passive mode. We use generally when we are far away from Titan and other objects. Scatterometry is an active mode, and Steve Ostra, who is on the radar team, is our main expert on radar scatterometry. We use altimetry on Titan and imaging. The imaging mode is SAR, synthetic aperture radar. This is the same mode that was used by Magellan on Venus. It also has been widely used on Earth because it can, you know, penetrate to cloud, and, you know, haze, whatever. But we only use the SAR mode at altitudes below about 4,000 kilometers. We are kind of, you know, pushing that up, you know, a bit now. And spatial resolution about 300 meters to a kilometer. And what we obtain is a swath about 120 to 450 kilometers wide using five antenna beams, which I'm going to show in the next slide. So the coverage we can get on Titan is dependent on the spacecraft range and also on the geometry. So we don't have a lot of choice over the areas where we can observe. So even if we want to observe, for example, I'd love to take a look at that VIM snail with radar, but that's not proving easy to do. Maybe we will be able to do that in the extended mission. Next slide, number 12, shows the Cassini radar, essentially how it operates. If we look straight down, if we look nature, we get our altimetry footprint. And so far, we have obtained altimetry over shorter, let's say, altimetry swaths on Titan than we have SAR. And we have the results of the altimetry I'm not really going to discuss today, but let's just say that it's showing very shallow slopes. It's not showing any mountains or, you know, major features. But we don't have any altimetry yet over any parts that we have SAR, because as you see here in this drawing, you can't use altimetry at the same time that you use SAR. So we use altimetry when we're a bit further out than 4,000 kilometers, and we look nadir. And then we turn the spacecraft sideways, because this is a side-looking radar, and that's how you get an image. So you get the image swath. And as the mission progresses, we'll be able to get altimetry over the same parts that we get SAR. Also, if we get two SAR swaths crossing over each other, we can then tricks with the radar image processing, essentially, and actually get topography. It's a bit like using stereo for images. Next slide, number 13. Shows, again, it's our sequence of observations, and it's a different way of looking at it. So we, from 30,000 kilometers and above, we use radiometry. Down to about 10,000 kilometers, we use scatterometry, and then we use altimetry, and finally we use SAR. And let's go on to the next slide now, number 14, our initial encounters. And here are the two initial SAR swaths, TA and T3, which are on the same hemisphere. They are mapped over the ISS, one of the earlier ISS mosaics. And as you can see, ISS has not yet imaged the northern part of Titan, so TA is really over Terra Incognita, and radar is the only instrument that has had a look there. So TA, we got scatterometry, radiometry, altimetry, T3, we got a longer SAR swath because TA was actually shared with INMS. But we didn't get the whole path, so we didn't get in and out scatterometry and radiometry. And some of the correlations you can see a little bit from this image, but generally there are correlations between what is radar light or bright and what is bright in imaging, but not always. Because you know, radar is not looking at the even necessarily at the very top surface as imaging is. You know, we can actually penetrate a few centimeters. Next slide shows slide number 15 shows the recent encounters. The first was T7 that happened in September. In fact, while a lot of us were in England at the Division for Planetary Sciences meeting, and we kept getting these emails about how there were, you know, problems, which, you know, if Trina hasn't explained to you the problems why we only got half the swath, she could go into it at great length. We lost a lot of data. Luckily, we actually got half of the SAR swath. You know, it was unlucky, but, you know, given what we managed to get, you know, perhaps we actually, you know, the fate chose it so that, you know, we got the best possible part of the data. And again, here it's plotted over imaging, and the correlations of dark, light and dark are not quite so good for this area. And then you see it better when it's plotted over this HST globe, and we do these plots, you know, mainly to show you the radar coverage as we are acquiring them. And here in the corner, you got TA and T3 for reference. And our last encounter, you know, we can argue was our best one, was T8. We got, you know, this beautiful long swath, and lots of interesting stuff, and the encounter went very, very well. So sometimes you really get lucky. And that happened on the 28th of October, which also happened to be my only son's birthday. You know, but we were lucky because we didn't actually get the date until the next day, so I actually could spend his birthday with him. The number 17, little explanation about SAR, because SAR is really what you use to see geology, so that's what, you know, I'm going to go into. It's a bit tricky to do geology with SAR, and in fact, I had never used SAR before to analyze data, so, you know, it's still a bit new to me, but what you measuring what you're seeing are variations in surface slope, surface roughness, and dielectric properties. So you actually have to be careful when you interpret geology from SAR. On Titan, your likely surface materials, you know, ice, ammonia, water, ice mixtures, hydrocarbons, tholins, they're very different from those of bodies previously imaged with planetary radars, which, you know, mostly Earth and Venus. And the way the radar waves are scattered may be very different on Titan. So we have to be, this is just something to tell you that we have to be pretty careful in our interpretations of what type of geology we're seeing, we saw. Luckily, there are geologic features which tell you about geologic processes that they stand out really well in SAR. Slide number 18 shows, you know, we're still actually now writing a mapping paper using SAR, and we're still in the what I consider the initial identification of geologic units. In TA and T3, we see 8 units that we actually identified and correlated between the swaths. We haven't finished doing that for T7 and T8 yet. But we can map these units based on the radar brightness variations, the general shape, the texture, and but we have to be careful about classifying them as rock or ice or stratigraphic units. And look at what unit was laid down before what, because with radar it's actually pretty complicated, and we don't yet fully understand the causes of variation in radar brightness. It could be composition, it could be scattering effects, it could be roughness. But, as we analyze the data more and as we get more data and correlate the swaths, we are getting much better at this. Now, we see cryovolcanic features in the first swath, TA, possibly T3 and T8. Actually, I consider myself very lucky. I was really hoping for cryovolcanism on Titan so that I would have something to do, and right in the first swath, we see several features that we think are cryovolcanic. While a colleague of mine on the team, Chuck Wood, he's an expert on impact craters, and he was hoping to study craters. We didn't see any craters at all in the first swath, so he was getting rather worried that there wouldn't be anything for him to do. But in T3, we found 2 craters for him, so that was good. We also find sinuous features and fun-shaped units in all the swaths, meaning, again, the fluid transport of material. We find a coastline in T7, which is a candidate for liquids, and I'm going to show you all those. 2 impact craters in T3. These features that we call cat scratches, which we interpret as dunes, in T3 and T8, and possibly tectonic features in T8. So the variety of geologic processes is just incredible. In fact, when you were I'm going to backtrack now a bit just to say that when you look at solid surfaces of planets, every solid surface of every planet is an interplay of 4 major geologic processes. You have the endogenic processes, which are volcanism and tectonism, and the exogenic processes, which are impact cratering and erosion. And how the surface of a planet will look depends on which processes were, existed and were dominant at particular times. So, for example, on Earth, we don't see many impact craters because we have had plate tectonics, destroying, features, and we, have a lot of erosion. On the Moon, we still see a lot of impact craters. So it's really the interplay of these processes that determines what the surface of a planet will look like. And Titan looks like it's got all of them. So this is really exciting for us. And to unravel the geologic history of Titan, we have to unravel how these processes fit together and at what particular times. So let's go to 19. This is part of the TA swath, and show the right in our first swath, we see a remarkable diversity of features, including several flow-like features. So if we look at the top swath, we have the round feature, which is called Ganesa macula. We'll go into it in more detail. We think that's a cryovolcanic dome. We have a number of flow features to the right, including fan-like deltas, which may be cryovolcanic or they may be alluvial, but again indicate the transport of material. To the right of that, some sort of fairly smooth, what appears smooth, perhaps homogeneous planes, but with some darker patches. There is an arrow-type feature. It's the on the top part on the right-hand side of the swath. It actually looks like it could be some kind of tectonic feature because of these straight lines. And if we go to the bottom slough, there is right in the middle what we call nicknamed CC, the Halloween cat. And this radar dark area, dark in radar normally means smooth, and we think this might be ponds and might be candidates for surface liquids. You know, one of my colleagues calls this a cryo swamp, and so maybe we have not oceans on Titan, maybe not many lakes, but we might have sort of swampy areas of these interconnected ponds. And on the far right of the second swath, a really big flow that we think is a big cryovolcanic flow. So right in the first data we got, we see this great variety of geologic features. And then slide 20, just an example of how we actually try to map features and classify them. Here, a homogeneous unit, or the H. This sort of darkish unit that appears to be homogeneous, and possibly icy plains, and then other areas. This the bright area at the bottom is actually the toe of that big flow that appear rougher and definitely different. If we go to the next one, some other examples, here we see where we drew a boundary, although it's not a very well-defined one, between the homogeneous unit and what we call the mottled unit, which appears to have this bright, small-scale features, but we're not quite sure what these features are. But we know it's a different kind of region, and we see the same type of feature in the T3 swath, but it's actually brighter and more extensive. So part of our work now is to actually correlate these various units in the different swaths. Slide 22 shows again a different type of unit, and that's what we call a hummocky unit. And you can see that it's much rougher, and it might be a small hill. It's very, much more textured, and appears to be embayed by the surrounding plains. That means it's possibly older than the surrounding plains. But one of the things we have to figure out in geologic mapping, if we can, is what came first and what came second, because that's how you reconstruct the geologic history of a surface. And these hummocky units occurs in both TA and T3, and I'm not going to go through all of the different units now, but this just gives you an idea how we do mapping and of the different features that we see on different swaths. And slide, now which number is this, 23, is the dark mottled unit, CC, the Halloween cat. We call it DM, or the dark mottled unit. And on the figure on the right, you can actually see some sort of oxbow shapes that could be fronts of liquids. So we, I don't like to say guess, but we think that these areas may be surface liquids. They're certainly candidate areas for surface liquids, but we can't prove it. And in fact, it's turning out to be a very difficult thing to do, is to actually prove that any features, even the lake that ISS sees, is actually liquid. That's still... a lot of observations and a lot of work to do. Next slide, 24. The features that, are actually easier to identify and identify what they are features such as the flows and the fans and the deltas that we actually can see from their morphology, pretty much get an indication of what process formed them. And these two fan-like features, they are much larger in scale than the Huygens channels, but, they could be essentially narrow channels. That's what we think they are. Narrow channels will open out into these fan-like deposits, probably because of a change in topography. And what this is indicating is transport and deposition of materials. So erosion is happening on Titan. And what is the process exactly that's transporting the material? Well, it could be a river type process, or it could be cryovolcanic. And this is yet it's not possible to sort out which one it is, but it's definitely evidence of liquids that have been transported on the surface, have flowed on the surface, and also evidence of some topography, because narrow channels actually open out into these big flows, and it would be great if we could get some altimetry or some crossover swath over this area to actually tell us this topography. In T3, the next slide, number 25, we got more evidence of these channels. There's very nice deposit here that we think it's definitely alluvial. Ralph Lorenz from Arizona is writing a paper on these features at the moment, and we see channels that are actually draining. They're flowing from the bottom to the top and draining into a depositional area. And these dendritic braided meandering channels are, very characteristic of river channels on Earth that, split up and regroup, and so on. And there is not a lobate deposit here, so we don't think this is cryovolcanic. We think that this is much more likely to be alluvial. Next slide, T726, slide number 26, that shows our famous T7 coastline. And this is one of the best, sort of pieces of evidence we have for surface liquids in the past or the present. I think the, most clear indicators that we have seen are the ISS lake, which probably most of you have seen, and this feature, this coastline. Here you see on the left-hand side a bright, a rough region that appears to be topographically higher. It's cut by channels and bays, and then this boundary, which we think is a shoreline. And within the dark, there are patterns that don't show up very well here, but that indicate flow. The big question is this liquid now, or was this liquid in the past? And we can't answer that yet. But at least we have the indication that there have been areas such as lakes or big lakes in the past. And the next slide shows here a comparison of T7 is our most clear, let's say, coastline feature. T8, our recent data, well, there are these dark patches that, perhaps could be another, probably older coastline, but, most of us are still, not very convinced by this. But, there may be a lot of areas on Titan that, were liquid in the past and, are not now, and but you still see some evidence of them. And it's one of the big questions that perhaps for our next mission to sort out is how much liquid actually exists now on the surface. So our next 28, our next, let's say, big class of feature are impact craters, and these are the two impact craters that we have seen, and they are the only two impact craters clearly seen on Titan so far. And the top one is actually a basin. It's a pretty big crater, about 450 kilometers across. It has an inner, an outer, and an inner ring. You can see the rings are bright. And this is sort of characteristic of basins. You see basins on the moon and Mercury. mercury with concentric rings. We only see part of it in our swath, but you know, it is evidence of a very large impact. The crater has been named Minerva. It's apparently pronounced the same way that Minerva is pronounced from Roman mythology. And the second crater, a smaller crater, 80 kilometers across, it looks more like your characteristic impact crater with a big ejecta blanket. That's been named Synlab. And both of these are deities of wisdom. Minerva or Minerva is Etruscan, and I should know, but I forget where Synlab is from. In fact, recently I joined the nomenclature group for the International Astronomical Union, the task group for outer planets. So I'm now helping decide on these names. And you know, I think I would have picked another name than this funny spelled Minerva that none of us is quite sure how to pronounce. But going back to the craters, so those are the only two clear indication of impacts that we have seen on the surface. ISS has seen features that circular features that might be impact, but we haven't had definite evidence yet. The basin, actually the left side of the basin appears to be much more eroded than the right side, and I'm going to show a picture in more detail later, but you can see here at the bottom some channels. So there is evidence that this is pretty old and has been eroded. Now, Titan, because it has an atmosphere, it does provide some protection of the surface, against the smaller meteorites, like, similar to what the Earth does. And on Titan, you need impactors greater than about 2 kilometers in diameter, which would form a crater about 20 kilometers in diameter. So you don't expect to see lots of small craters on Titan. But what's been surprising is that at least compared to the impacts on other satellites of Saturn, we have seen far less on Titan than we had expected. The next slide, 29, shows a nice comparison between radar and VIMS. And this is a way for the Synlab crater, and this is a way of showing how putting together data from different instruments really, helps your understanding of particular features. We have VIMS at 2.03 microns, which is one of their methane windows. Then the radar T3 and a VIMS false collar made from three different wavelengths. And the VIMS, actually, if you compare the images, you see the extent of the impact ejecta around the crater is different. And on the false collar VIMS, you see that it has a faint halo that is shown here as bluer than the central bright material. And this is implying a different composition or perhaps grain size. And as an impact excavates the deep layers of the surface, what happens during an impact, the top layers will be ejected and land closer to the crater, and then the layers that are excavated, as you go deeper, as the shock from the impact excavates those layers, those will end up on top and on the outer edges.
Dr. Lopez?
Yes.
What is causing the break in the swath in T3?
Oh, that's a data gap. And
so why does it come in square blocks? If the imager images with a circular disk, wouldn't they have a circular section to it?
Interesting question. I never thought about that. I think it's because the radar beams are actually pretty small compared to what you see here. So it's a gap in time, and actually, and probably also, you know, radar engineers, you know, didn't use, like, you know, pieces of data, so they cut it there. But, you know, frankly, I don't know exactly the answer to that, why it looks square. I never thought about that.
Why there was the data loss to begin with?
I'm sorry?
You know why there was the data loss to begin with?
I can't actually remember. I think it was a DSN problem. Trina, do you remember?
Yeah, this was the transition from one-way to two-way. That we have a small dropout that occurs when we have when the spacecraft transitions from coherent to non-coherent. And this time it was radar that took the hit.
Right, and this is, you know, still possible that it might happen, right?
Yeah, it happens in every downlink. It's a gap of about 2 minutes. It happens in every downlink that we have in the mission, and we decided we wouldn't do anything about it. But then, after seeing this, we said, well, that's maybe not the best answer.
That's right.
Act for targeted flybys and protect ourselves from this. So now we protect ourselves from this kind of outage.
Can the speaker identify themselves for the transcript?
John Haller, and I'm calling from Menlo Park.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you for your comment.
Okay, well, you know, actually, if you send me an email, I'll, you know, find out the answer about the, you know, the squares. I mean, you're right, because our beams are circular. But, you know, I something I never noticed before. So thanks for bringing it to my attention.
Okay.
Okay, so I think we can, you know, move on from this. But this is a comparison, again, showing how useful it is to put various instruments together. And something else that you can see here is the center of the crater is dark and the VIM is 2.03 microns. And you're actually seeing that the eject is pretty different because it's light on VIMs, while on radar is about the same. You know, on radar is, you know, showing, you know, essentially here I think is that the roughness is similar, while a VIMs is showing, you know, the IR properties. Also, the depth that these different instruments sample is different. You know, radar is actually, you know, sampling a few centimeters deep, while the VIMs, you know, just kind of seem, you know, very, very, very thin top layer. Next slide, number 30, the famous cat scratches, some of our favorite features, which we think are dunes. Now, we first saw these in T3. They are not present at all in TA, in the first swath. And they are, you know, all over in T3. And we just looked at them and thought, wow, what are those? And we thought of, you know, tectonic features, but they, you know, really don't look like tectonic features, and we thought of, you know, fluid flow, and you know, eventually the best explanation we came up with is that they are longitudinal dunes. Here is a picture from the Arabian Peninsula, so this, you know, happened a lot on Earth, and now that we are looking for more of them, we, you know, find a lot of these, you know, dunes in Namibia and other places, so they are they form along the direction of wind. In TA, we see some areas that where there might be some very faint ones, but you know, it's the kind of case that if you think something is there, then you can go back to the data, you know, try to see it. But we're not convinced yet. But they are all over in T3 and in T8. T3 and T8 are more equatorial swaths, so we think that actually there is a control, you know, where the, you know, winds are stronger in the equatorial regions. And the next slide shows a close-up, in fact, of the side of that impact basin Minerva, and it shows here the channels at the bottom. And it shows these patches of, we call them cat scratch patches. And these two look actually like the paws of a cat, and that's why we nicknamed them cat scratches, because now that's what they look like before we actually started interpreting them as dunes. And in some places they are kind of truncated pretty abruptly. In other places they sort of fade away. and they are dark in radar. They are also dark at optical wavelength. And we are trying to correlate now radar and VIMS. So far, with working with members of the VIMS team, we have not found a difference in composition between the cat scratch patches and other areas. But you know, if they are dunes, you wouldn't, you know, really expect to see a difference in composition. It's just material moved around. Now in T8, the next slide, 32, we see them in a lot more detail and can really put them in context. And there is a paper by Ralph Lorenz that's actually, you know, being submitted. It's going to be submitted in the next few days to Nature, where you know we actually you know argue really that these are dunes, and you can see in the bottom image here how nicely these dune features go around what appears to be a topographic high, you know, so they are like you know diverted. And you see these on dunes on Earth, and T8 has really been a revelation for the cat scratches. They you know they really look much more like dunes now. T8 also showed us in the next slide some features that appear to be tectonic, and these apart from the small arrow type feature that I showed you in TA. We have not seen a sort of conclusive evidence of tectonic, but we now see a lot of linear features that really may be like ridges. Now, tectonism is not the only explanation. We could even have cryovolcanism along long fractures. But, you know, we don't exactly know what these are yet, but, you know, long linear features that, you know, appear like in some tectonic process has taken place. And here you see a number of cat scratches as well, particularly on the right-hand side. And, you know, the TA swath just got a lot of them. But the big excitement of T8 in the next swath is actually the radar was able to observe the Huygens landing site. And the reason we wanted to do that was to provide context for the Huygens landing site, and is also to find out, well, you know, we see all these channels and things in the Huygens images. Now, what do they look like in radar? And in fact, you don't see those in radar. I mean, it was actually pretty difficult to even match the DISA landing site with the radar. Now, this is a good estimate. It's not the best one. You know, unfortunately, there's a press release tomorrow, and I can't show you the latest yet. But if you look in the Cassini website in the next couple of days, there's an ESA press conference tomorrow in Europe, and the stuff should be released in the website in the next couple of days. But we had a couple of people in our team, particularly Larry Soderblom and Jonathan Lunin, actually spending, you know, quite a bit of time trying to match the radar with Huygens. Now, one difficulty is that this is pretty low resolution SAR. We, in fact, extended the SAR swath beyond what we would normally get to be able to get the Huygens landing site. So this is like 1,200 meter resolution, while you know, our closest approach, we normally have about 300 to 350 meters. And it does make a big difference what you can see in terms of geology. In fact, Jonathan Lunin just sent me today some terrestrial radar images of Italy, and he actually degraded the resolution and you know, and showed it at you know 350 meters and 1200, and the difference in what you can see in the geology is just amazing. So this is not the best possible radar data we can get over the landing site, and we hope to have other opportunities in the future. So I hope that you look for the press releases in the website in the next couple of days. And something that, you know, I can actually give you this hint is if you look at the panorama image that was obtained by DISA, and I'm not quite sure exactly where in the website it is, but it was taken kind of closer to landing and shows a beautiful panorama. You can actually see in the distance some cat scratches that, you know, only now that we know what they are, you know, we actually can correlate them with cat scratches. But, you know, it's really pretty amazing. Next slide, now getting on to what I really like to talk about since it's getting to the end of this telecom. Ganesha macula. Well, I like cryovolcanism, and I'm going to spend a little bit of time on my favorite subject. Macula, by the way, is just a name given to a dark feature, usually in the nomenclature committee. Unless the interpretation of a feature is really clear, we try not to sort of make geologic interpretations. Names like macula are useful because you can say, okay, it's a dark feature, so we call it a macula. Bright feature, you call it a facula. And we're pretty sure this is now a cryovolcanic dome, but at the time it was named, we were still being cautious. And it's about 180 kilometers across, so it's pretty large compared to a lot of the pancake domes on Venus, which, you know, we also show here at the bottom. And these are two pancake domes on Venus, and we think that's what Ganesha macula is. You know, a pancake dome is a steep-sided dome, and is essentially formed by the extrusion of magma or cryomagma that's quite viscous and relatively low in gas content, so it's not explosive. And like the Venus domes, this has a central depression. Ganesha also has some channels that may be cryolava channels, or they may have been formed later. We are still working on the interpretation. And a number of flow features to the right of it. Little image here, Ganesha is the Hindu god, is the Hindu god of good fortune, and my colleague Randy Kirk found this image. Next slide, the projections for Titan's geology. Pre-Cassini included cryovolcanism, most likely of, cryovolcanism, of course, cold volcanism, so it's not magma, it's not molten rock. It's water, or more likely a mixture of water and other constituents, such as ammonia. Now, ammonia-water mixtures are consistent with compositional models of Titan, and a lower ammonia also lowers the melting point, the density, and the mobility of liquid water. So it's actually easier to erupt an ammonia-water mixture than it would be to erupt pure water. Ice cubes float, so that gives you the idea. You know, you will actually need something else or some process to actually, you know, get this liquid water to the surface. And the interesting thing about ammonia water mixtures, there was a lot of work done by Jeff Cargill from Arizona State. University of Arizona. In the early 90s, about the rheology and the viscosity of these mixtures. And in fact, they can produce features very similar to what you would get on Earth with basaltic and other magmas, because ammonia water actually has a high viscosity. And another prediction by my colleague Ralph Lorenz was that these cryomagmas would probably have a relatively low amount of methane, which would be the main volatile, and not enough at Titan's atmospheric pressures to produce explosive eruptions. And in fact, we don't actually see any features that look like features caused by explosive eruptions, such as steep-sided cones. And Ralph actually predicted that pancake domes might be the most likely volcanic landform. And, you know, we see flows and we see a pancake dome, so it was a good, you know, prediction. Next slide shows you, you know, just closer up of Ganesha Macula and some comparison with a variety of Venus domes. So that's what we think it is. Now go on to the next slide, 38. We also see this very long flows. And on the right-hand side, you see a crater with a flow coming out of it. Now, people can argue if you see long flows on the surface like this biggest one, this bright one, how do you know if it's cryovolcanic? It might be alluvial. But when you see a crater with a flow coming out of it, it's, you know, pretty difficult to do that with anything else than volcanism. And we see in TA this and another crater with a flow coming out of it. So we are, you know, and together with Ganesha Macula and so on, we're pretty convinced that, you know, cryovolcanism has been a major process on Titan. But, you know, the origin of particular flows, such as this large bright flow, you could still argue a bit, even though to do it from, you know, rainfall, might take an unreasonable amount of rainfall. And then the next figure, slide 39, actually show that this, you know, this big flow with these lobate shapes and actually seems to be coming out of a series of fissures. And unfortunately, our swath cuts off there, so we don't actually see much of the source. Might be similar to what you see in Mauna Loa. This is an image on the right of Mauna Loa taken from Circe, again, radar. And it actually shows here a rift zone with a number of flows coming out of it. So it might be something similar to that. Next slide, number 40. It's more about how you tell a cryovolcanic feature. An association with a vent is really the key sign that you look for. So a crater, a caldera, a fissure, they form constructs such as domes and shields, lobate deposits, and going into cryolavas a bit, although they are erupted at much lower temperatures than silicate lavas, they can resurface vast areas, they can form this, you know, landforms similar to what you see on Earth, such as shields and domes. And the composition is something we're trying to get at now, because the composition of these cryolavas has a large effect on the viscosity. Ammonia water has rheological properties similar to silicate lavas, so you would see that in the flow thickness. You would expect some well-defined thick margins that you see in some of these flows. The final morphologies, such as a pancake dome. And I have a postdoc here at JPL, Carl Mitchell, who is actually, you know, doing, you know, modeling, may start doing some laboratory work with these mixtures. And something we are finding is that perhaps water ammonia is not actually enough. Some of these flows appears to be of very high viscosity, and maybe there is something else like methanol involved in these mixtures. But something that is interesting is that it's very hard to get the composition of these lavas by other means. For example, you know, VIMS has not detected any ammonia on the surface at all. You know, and at the depth that VIMS sees, actually may not see any ammonia because, you know, you may have a layer of ice at the surface, so that's all you see. And these rheological measurements, these thickness measurements that you do, like, you know, according to, for example, if you have a channel and a thickness of a channel margin, you can use models to infer the viscosity. And this may actually be our only way at the moment of getting at the composition, is to actually do this rheological analysis, look at the final morphology of the deposit, do modeling experiments to actually try to see what the composition of that cryolava was. Now, did we see cryolavas, you know, anywhere else than TA? TA, we have, you know, a little bit, some features that, you know, might be calderas. T3 here are shown in slide 41. There are some, if you see towards the top and in the middle, there is a feature that I actually call them a little comet. And this could be a crater with a flow. Unfortunately, the resolution is not good enough to tell. And we're still discussing T8 whether there are some features that, you know, they appear to be like calderas and they might be or might not. But the first flyby was the one that really showed us conclusive evidence of cryovolcanism. And finally, well, slide 42 shows a, you know, a location map for you know, for the recent, actually not upcoming, but the recent flybys. So it's just another way of seeing it. And slide 43 shows a planning map of the coverage during the mission. So we're actually going to have some of this crossover of swaths, which I think are really, really important because we can get topography from this crossover swaths. And if we actually really knew the topography, we'd be able to much better constrain the geology of these features. And slide 44, you know, in conclusion, the surface we have seen is, you know, very young. Actually, I forgot to update this number, but, you know, we've seen over 4% now. It's a dynamic surface. We see some smooth areas that may be liquids, but we can't tell yet. We see a variety of geologic processes, cryovolcanism, fluid flow, these channels, erosion, deposition, couple of impact craters, aeolian processes in the cat scratches and dunes, and probably some tectonics. So it's again the you know, the wide range of geologic processes and how they interplay with one another, and you know how the surface of Titan really evolved is you know, going to be the subject for study for a long time. So thank you very much, and you know, if you have questions, I'll be pleased to answer. Ooh, anybody there?
Usually we have questions. So Rosalie, what's something that you're looking forward to in the upcoming radar activities?
Well, more and more and more SAR. I'm actually looking forward to some more of this high latitude passes, maybe at the same latitudes as TA, just because, you know, they might show more cryovolcanic features, and this is just a sort of gut, you know, instinct. But because we see so many cat scratches and, you know, aeolian deposition in the closer to the equatorial regions, they may be masking some of the cryovolcanic features if they're older. You know, so perhaps at high latitudes we have, you know, better chance of seeing more. And I'm also looking forward to some of these crossover swaths. You know, for example, if we get to 20, because, you know, that would enable us to actually get topography by using the two different looks. So it's like a radar stereo. And but I think that, I mean, everywhere we have looked is interesting. And even, you know, down to the end of the nominal mission, we only have about 20% of the surface, and you know, and everything is going to be interesting. There is always going to be something new. Every swath so far has looked somewhat different from the previous ones, and we see new things.
Hi, I have a question.
Yeah?
This is John Vitello from Park Ridge. Are there any pancake domes on Earth? And also, could you describe, you know, how a pancake dome is created, and the difference between a you know, a more pyramid shaped volcano?
Okay, it's a matter of composition and how the you know, I'm going to use lava as general, you know, maybe cryolava. Domes, what you need to form domes, you know, it's essentially high viscosity and low gas content so that you don't get explosions. We see a variety of domes on Earth, such as Lassen Peak, but that's more of a sort of, you know, pyramid, you know, type type dome. The Mount St. Helens dome is sort of lower, you know, it's not quite pancake-ish, but it's more getting there. In fact, you know, at least it used to be. I can't remember what the if the latest eruptions actually have modified the shape some, but you know, Mount St. Helens used to be closer to a pancake dome, and you need slow extrusion as well. So you get this slow extrusion of lava, you know, and then the high pressures on Venus, you know, help, you know, sort of, you know, flatten it. But it's a matter of low gas content, high viscosity, and generally they are very slow extrusion. Now, I can't think, is a good question, I can't think of any dome on Earth that I would call or has been called by volcanologists a pancake dome. You know, that is actually a term used for, very much used for Venus. And I should say here that we don't have clear evidence that the Ganesha actually has steep sides like the domes on Venus. But we know that the south side, which was facing the radar, is bright, you know, so that indicates a slope. But it could be more similar to the Mount St. Helens dome, for example. The top appears to be pretty uniform, so that might be evidence, again, that's kind of flat. But, you know, I really would love another look with either altimetry or a crossover pass over that region.
Thank you.
Dr. Lopez?
Yeah?
This is John Haller again, and I have a question about finding liquid on the surface.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I have a couple questions. One, do you know the temperature of the surface so you can know the likelihood of water actually being able to be there? And you mentioned that if it's mixed with ammonia, then it could have a lower boiling point.
Yeah, there are kind of two different things. But anyway, finish asking your question.
And also, have you done any statistical analysis to determine the likelihood of the dark patches that you have seen? Is that actually a swamp or actually liquid? Can you give like a percentile probability that it is?
Well, I don't actually know that you could do a statistical analysis to, you know, I'm not sure what you would use to actually say whether it's liquid or not. It's the liquid wouldn't be, you know, water. You could have water ammonia for a short period of time if it was an eruption before it froze. But the liquid on the surface, particularly if it's a pond or a lake, is methane, likely to be, methane or ethane. Because of the surface temperature of Titan, so it wouldn't be water, and the mixture such as water ammonia would only, you know, flow like over short periods of time. But you know, it's really a big question we have on Cassini right now is how do we actually tell that even these candidate areas are liquid? You might be able to tell with radar altimetry. Like how smooth the area really is, the best chance you have is actually to use optical instruments and try to see glints of the surface. But if these areas are small, you actually need, you know, particular geometry observations to be able to see this glints from the surface. And Trina, you might actually know when we are doing observations like that with the ORS instruments?
I do not. I should.
And
but
I don't remember either. So we are, you know, and the best evidence we have for liquids on Titan is from ground-based observations. and actually, but you know, done with radar, but at different wavelengths than the Cassini radar. So the liquids also might be subsurface, and it could be that the optical instruments would then never be able to see them. Maybe we'll actually be able to, have to go there and sample to be able to tell, if it's presently a liquid or not. Or with a Titan orbiter, you probably get enough observations that you could do it.
Titan rovers,
that's right. And then if the rovers sink, it's liquid.
Last question. When you're in radar altimeter mode, what's the resolution in terms of resolving differences in height?
Of height, it's a few meters. It sort of depends, where you're looking. And let me see if I can pull. Oh, of course, I can't email any pictures to you, can I? But one of the problems with altimetry is that we get very, very short areas that we look at with altimetry. They're typically very very short paths, and if you don't actually have the context, like you haven't seen the area we saw, it's difficult to figure out what you're actually looking at. I'm going to point you out to a paper that we published. In fact, all of you might be interested in this. Published in Science is on the 13th of May this year, 2005, volume 308, and is by Elachi et al. And that's a team paper on the results of the TA flyby. And we have several other papers in the works, but the others haven't been published yet. And that actually has an altimetry track, and you can actually see the errors and the elevation. And so far, what we have found is, just very very shallow slopes. It doesn't mean that there couldn't be mountains on Titan, but we haven't seen them. And also the width of the beam is pretty large. It's about, well, for TA it was about 25 kilometers in horizontal resolution. So, altimetry, is good, but it has its limitations, particularly when you're trying to do the, sort of, let's say, the detailed geology.
Thanks.
Do we have any other questions?
Yeah, this is Ken in North Carolina. Got a question about slide 28.
Okay, let me go back to that.
And it has to do with the Synlab crater in the T3 SAR image. There's a bunch of what look like ghost craters in that image.
Oh, yes.
what are those?
Well, we wish we knew. We talked about ghost craters a lot. and they could be ghost craters. But if you look at the next slide in VIMS, maybe VIMS doesn't quite have the resolution, but you see perhaps slightly different types of ghost craters. so there are lots of features like that you almost see with radar, but may discuss it in the team, but we can't really say with certainty.